Last Sunday morning when we started getting ready for church, I said to my husband, oh, let's get ready soon because I don't want to miss the singing again. I really like it. So we rushed and we got there on time finally to get the singing. And we sat down and we sang some songs and that they were thinking about, you know, what's going to be the next song? And he was kind of thinking of that extemporaneously and said, oh, let's sing Teach Me Thy Way, O Lord. And I love that song. And that, I think, is what we're going to be talking about today. Teach me thy way, O Lord, not the way that I want your gospel to be, but teach me the way your gospel really is.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Very often, people come up to me and ask me, hey, do you and Jack have an outline? Do you speak from an outline and kind of go step by step? And my answer is always, of course, no. Usually what we do is we have a topic in mind and we just go extemporaneously from whatever starting point we have. And then people ask me, so how do you decide on what topics? And I say, well, kind of whatever comes to mind that seems relevant and helpful and comes up in the lives of our lives and the people around us. Would you say that's about right, Jack?
Mm-hmm. That's very right.
There's no way in the world that this program has been canned or scripted beforehand. It is very much what happens between you and I in the moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what gives it life for me and what makes it really interesting for me. I'm not trying to do anything but have integrity with whatever moment we're in right at that time. Anyway, all that to say, just kind of give people an idea of where we're coming from. And how did we come up with the topic we're going to do today? Well, the way we came up with it is I was sitting in church listening to you preach a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, man, that would really be a good thing to cover on the radio program because it was so helpful to me. And hopefully it will be helpful to other people.
I hope so.
There is a very popular radio personality who talks a lot about morality. And that's kind of the topic of our conversation today. Is the gospel essentially moral in nature? We need to make moral choices based on rules. Or is it moral perhaps in a different way? Or is the gospel basically religious? Are we supposed to follow some kind of scripted way of worshiping God? And is that what he wants from us? Is that pretty close to what you were thinking, Jack?
Yeah, actually, it's not exactly what I was thinking, but now that you mention it, yeah, that's what you asked me to do. So, yeah, let's go there.
So how would you answer those questions?
Well, my brief answer would be, yes, Christianity, the faith that Jesus came to promote in the world, is moral rather than religious. And to answer the first part of the question, and the second part of the question is, it's not primarily rule-driven, but, and then it gets hard to define.
And I think that's what we're going to try and define today.
Is what the alternative to rule-driven morality is.
Yeah.
We
because in a rule-driven morality, there's some pretty easy answers. When someone asks a question, very often I kind of hear a feeling of, well, of course this is the answer. Well, it's pretty simple. If you just look at these particular ways of functioning in the world, or you look at these rules, you just obey the rules. Come on, read them, do them. And I really have a different sense of what the gospel is saying than that. It's more difficult than that on one hand, and it's more freeing on the other hand.
Right. I think that's right. Rules are, I mean, what you see when Jesus came to earth was in the pages of the gospel is that he was confronting a religious establishment that had sought to reduce righteousness or morality to a set of rules, and very meticulously so. They had a very strict and meticulous obedience to a very complicated set of codes. What Jesus was suggesting to these Pharisees is that, okay, you may be following the rules, but your heart is not right. I mean, I guess what I would oppose to rule morality would be maybe what we would call heart morality. That is, what are the commitments of the deep down inside me? Am I committed to what's good and what's right and what's loving and what's godlike because I love who God is and I want to be like him? Is that what is driving it? Or have I just accepted a definition of righteousness that I am willing to outwardly conform to?
And maybe in outwardly conforming to it, what's my motivation? I think that's a really important piece. Does it come out of my heart, out of the desire to be and do what's good? Or am I, in a sense, as a friend was telling me about the other day, she said, you know what? I don't think I get A's in school, but I think I try to get A's with God. And I think a lot of rule-driven morality is trying to get a good grade with God, kind of mm-hmm. be in there trying to do what he wants so that he'll like me. And that's where the freedom gets lost, because I'm doing it, I have to keep performing in order to get God to be
right.
on my side.
Right.
And it's really very much up to me to keep up.
Right.
Rather
exactly.
than the opposite of God doing a work in my heart. And I think that's where we're going to end up today, is God's doing a work in our heart to make us people who do have a heart morality.
Right. And the target audience that I have in mind for my grade point average with God may be other people, but it may just be myself as well.
I mean, or it may just be God.
And
I think there's usually
himself,
a combination of all those.
Yeah.
I'm going to get in trouble with God if I don't get an A. I'm not going to be liked by people, and I'm going to think of myself as a schmuck. So I better keep an A by obeying all these different rules.
Right. If you look in the rabbinic literature, the rabbis actually had a name for a Pharisee who was only being righteous for the sake of other people. And they kind of denigrated that as a really second-class Pharisee, that you really needed to do it for, I think they would have said, God, which sounds very noble. And yet there's still something fundamentally wrong with Phariseeism itself. And that is that they are defining morality itself by obedience to the rules. There's actually two problems with rule-driven morality. One is the one we've just been talking about. Is it really a good person who's keeping the rules, or is it just a clever, intelligent, rational person who's able to decipher quickly and motivate himself? Yeah. That's the first problem. The second problem is morality the kind of thing that can be captured by our rules? That's the other issue. And I think that's partly what you're objecting to, is does there come a point where, I mean, our rules might be very serviceable up to a point, but do they define morality everywhere, all the time, in every situation, on every occasion? Or can there be variables in a situation that would make the right and good thing to do be something that appears to violate my rule? And I think the biblical answer to that ultimately would be, yeah, it's ultimately more complicated than that. Our rules might be very serviceable to us and maybe generally true, but just because they are generally true doesn't make them absolutely true. Abraham faced that, for example, when, you know, presumably Abraham had some kind of rule about fathers should not kill their sons. That's a rule I follow. As a father, I won't kill my son. And yet God comes along and says, Abraham, I want you to offer your son up to me, and kill him in the process. What does he do now with that? There's this unknown variable that's come along, namely a direct commandment from God telling him what to do, that seems to violate one of his rules. What is he supposed to do with that? And a heart that's right with God will be able to handle that kind of anomaly, that kind of strange, weird situation that you didn't anticipate. It will still know the right thing to do. But somebody who's strictly playing by the rules gets really thrown off by a situation like that.
Well, I don't think it's even that quite that easy. I think you would agree with me that Abraham really didn't know what to do, but he sure wasn't only driven by rules that told him what to do. He then was able to back up into, okay, what do I need to think about? What are the ideas that I need to put into my head here? What are some variables that will help me understand the direction that I need to go in? So it isn't that that it becomes really easy. In fact, it becomes harder in a sense. If he just went by his rules, he could just say, never let your son get killed. Therefore, I don't even have anything to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're not rule-driven, there's a whole lot more to think about.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Right.
And that's part of the process. That thinking about it is part of the process of building the heart.
Right.
It is in and through that, those gray areas, those difficult decisions, that we build heart or we build a thin rigidity that we impose on ourselves, we impose on God, and we impose on other people. And ultimately, we can't be compassionate people. We're just people that are making sure that we're keeping ourselves and other people in line, even if ultimately that's not good or right.
Mm-hmm.
We have to believe it is because that's the only option we have.
Christians today in reaction to a relativistic culture that doesn't even believe there is such a thing as truth, let alone goodness and morality, are inclined to answer the relativism of our culture by saying we as Christians believe in moral absolutes. And I know what they're trying to say, and I wholeheartedly agree with what they're trying to say, but it's a very unfortunate way to express what they're trying to say, because it's misleading. Because we don't believe in moral absolutes, strictly speaking. What we believe in is in moral objectivity. That is, we believe that there is an objectively right and good thing to do in any situations. In other words, regardless of what culture I'm from, regardless of what point in history I'm in, regardless of who I am as an individual, given the right set of circumstances that I'm in, there's the right thing to do, and then there are all the other wrong things to do, and that's just an objective fact, that as God would define my situation, he would define one at least set of actions as right, and everything outside of that set of actions as wrong. When we define that as a moral absolute, that misleads us into thinking that we have these rules that are actually absolutely inviolable. And there may, in fact, be rules that are absolutely inviolable, but there are some of our moral rules that are not absolutely inviolable. That if we followed my rule, I would actually be doing the objectively wrong thing, which I think is what you're saying, that my rules could actually lead me to do evil, not good. If you put me in the right situation with different variables that the rule has not anticipated.
So let's go for an example that helps give us a better picture of a moral absolute as opposed to moral objectivity.
Okay, let's take the way some people take the commandment that God gave in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, and some people would see that as saying just kill, not murder, but kill. Well, if they interpret it that way and understand it that way and then decide that's a moral absolute, then, of course, they look at something like capital punishment and say, that's just wrong. No, it's wrong. The Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not kill, so it's wrong. Period. No discussion. Okay, well, we can solve, if we don't happen to believe that or agree with that, we can solve that problem by reinterpreting what the commandment is. Thou shalt not murder. Okay, now we have introduced a subtlety into it. You shall not kill in certain sorts of situations. Out of certain sorts of motives and out of certain, when that killing can be described in a certain way. Well, okay, but now we've already made a rule that is already relative to the situation, if you understand what I mean. It depends on what we're talking about, whether the killing is in moral violation or not, and we're kind of building that into the rule. Now, it may very well be that thou shalt not murder is a moral absolute because we've almost defined it we're basically saying you shall not kill in any way that violates this rule. I suppose that can be a moral absolute, because built into the definition of the rule is that if it is an exception to the rule, then it's not what the rule is defining. But if we try to define murder, could we ever find a situation where maybe the right and good thing that we should do would look like a violation of my definition of murder? I don't know. I mean, I'd have to think about that some more. But I don't think we can rule that out of hand. Because to believe firmly in moral absolutes really basically is to have the utmost confidence in my ability to define terms and clarify concepts in such a way that I can capture any and every situation. And I don't have that kind of confidence in my ability to look into the future and have that kind of clarity of concept. To hesitate to call it a moral absolute is not in any way to deny or qualify my belief in the moral objectivity of God's moral universe. There just is a right thing to do in any situation. There just is. But do I have the kind of knowledge and understanding that I can predict in ahead of time with my rules exactly that what that's going to be in every situation? I don't have that kind of confidence in me and my moral rules.
So as part of what you're saying, Jack, is there is objectively always a right and wrong. There mm-hmm. is always a good and bad. One is, one isn't. However, I can't always know that. It's out there, and I may be right on target doing the right thing, but I might be way off target thinking I'm doing the right thing.
Right.
And I need to be open to that and remain a teachable, open person to, did I make a good decision here or not? Is that kind of what you're saying? Is that part of it?
Yeah. I mean, let's take something that really gets very complex and very naughty, like divorce.
I was just going to talk about that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's a very good example, because there are a lot of Christians in Christian culture in recent decades who have said that's a moral absolute. Thou shalt not divorce, period.
Ever, never.
Yeah, ever, never. And, well, is that what the Bible's teaching? I don't think so, not with that kind of rigidity and inflexibility and unwillingness to take into account the individual situations and what they are and what lies behind them and what they mean. I don't think that's what Jesus was getting at. I don't think he presented it as a moral absolute to start with, and certainly to construe it as a moral absolute is to really oversimplify what Jesus was trying to get at in all of his teachings about divorce. And yet, against the cultural relativism of our day, it sounds so godly and holy and pious to uphold it as a moral absolute.
And I think in our talking about it in this way, we sound like moral relativists.
We may. I mean, to people who only have two categories, moral absolutism or moral relativism, then we probably do sound like moral relativists. All I can say is I'm not a moral relativist at all. I believe firmly and unquestioningly in the objective reality of moral goodness and moral truth. There is one and only one moral truth in any situation.
And I have to work hard at trying to understand what that is.
Exactly. It's not always easy to know what that is.
Often it's really hard.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes, in fairness to the people who want to make sure we don't drift into moral relativism, it is true that sometimes it's so hard, not because the truth itself is that inaccessible, but because we have different forces competing for the allegiance of my mind. I have my own desires. I have my own evil. I have my own agenda. And I just don't want to see the truth. And that's oftentimes what makes our moral dilemma so complicated, is we don't know what we really want. Not that we can't really see the truth, but we don't know what we really want, on the one hand. On the other hand, there are some situations that are just such difficult judgment calls, that involve judgment calls about such complex matters, that it really is difficult to see what the moral truth would be. That's true as well.
Well, I think it's even often difficult to see what the moral truth is, not because I really know it, but even though it might be simple to somebody else, I might not know it because I have all sorts of conflicting issues that are going on inside of me. So very often I don't know when it doesn't have to do with all the stuff inside of me conflicting to what's true. For example, if I was thinking about having another child, if that was the situation I was in now, I have three, I might decide, you know what, I think it would be best. I mean, that's not an answer that God gives me in the Bible, thou shalt have four children, or it's very open to the decision that I make. So I need to make the decision. I could say, you know what, I really think God doesn't want me to have four children. Well, and just kind of put it out of my mind. Well, the reality might be that the reason I don't want to have another child is because I just want to be lazy and selfish. And that's really what's motivating me. But instead of me really being able to look at what's best situation for myself, my family, my situation, I just get lost in what I really want, and then I make God the author of what I really wanted. And so I never really come to a sense of what's best here. I just stay with my own selfishness. And it could be that even if I looked, I wasn't really defeated by my own selfishness. If I really had the opportunity to look at all the angles, it could be that I'd end up not having the fourth child anyway. But it would be on a very different basis.
Right. Yeah, and I think probably 100% of our moral dilemmas have that dimension to them. Some of them, it seems to me, even if I could somehow manage to sort through and resolve all of my personal issues, and I was looking at a moral dilemma with just utter objectivity, and I'm not saying that's even possible, but even if it were possible to do that, it seems to me that we do end up with some problems that involve a kind of judgment call that would be difficult to make nonetheless. I think something like, what if I'm being asked to vote on some measure that involves the tax structure of our society? How am I going to make a judgment about what's the right and good and godly thing to do? Should I vote in this sort of tax structure or this sort of tax structure? Well, economics is so complex and so involved, and we do have different models of economics, and they all kind of make, all of them have a certain rationality to them that makes sense, but which one of them is really true? I mean, which one of them is really reflects the realities of human experience? And, well, I can see why people would disagree on that, because it's not like any perspective doesn't have something going for it. But how do I make the call about what I, as a person who wants to pursue godliness, how am I going to know what the really godly thing to do is when I don't even know enough to know how to think about the issue? Well, that's certainly something where my own self-interest is also going to come into play. You know, my first question is probably going to be, am I going to have to pay more or less taxes, you know, or something very self-centered. But even if I could get objectivity, even if I could get myself out of the equation, I still wouldn't know what to do, oftentimes.
And it is true sometimes, Jack, that we have equations that we have to decide on that really we're not a part of. Where it doesn't really benefit me one way or the other. I can be a whole lot more objective about, for example, a way a measure can be voted on in the state of Montana than in Oregon, where I live, because it's really not going to have an impact on me. And so the issues become much more clear when it's not going to impact me.
Right.
Or my children, or my family, or my lifestyle.
Right.
So, you know, I have this sense, Jack, that we're getting kind of out there.
We kind of left the topic.
We did. We really left it. So let's get back.
Okay. Yeah, what was right at the heart of your initial question was, what's really at the essence of my faith? I just ran across a passage this morning that I think captures what I'm trying to say. I don't want to go here about last times or anything like that, even though that's what this passage is talking about. This is talking about the man of lawlessness in the end times and all that kind of stuff. Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false, in order that they all may be judged who did not believe the truth, but took pleasure in wickedness. And it's that juxtaposition of they did not believe the truth, instead they took pleasure in wickedness, that I think is very interesting, because I think it really captures what is at the heart of the faith of the apostles and the faith that Jesus taught. This is not about what we believe primarily, and it is not about religion primarily. It's about morality. Do we or do we not take pleasure in wickedness? And what we believe from the perspective of Jesus and the apostles is ultimately rooted in what are the moral commitments of my heart? Do I take pleasure in what's good, or do I take pleasure in what's wicked? Do I take pleasure in what's godly, or do I take pleasure in what's ungodly somehow? If I do take pleasure in what's godly, then the truth is going to resonate with me. The truth is going to be attractive and interesting to me, and I will ultimately then believe it. I will embrace it, and I will acknowledge it as true because it's not repugnant to me. Because the truth is, frankly, that which God is doing in the world, that which God, who is good, is doing in the world. It's His good purposes going abroad in history. And I'm going to respond to that either by being repulsed by it because I am allergic to goodness, I hate goodness, I take no pleasure in it, it frankly ticks me off, or I'm going to be drawn to it because my pleasure is in godliness, is in goodness. And it's that attraction or repulsion to what is good that ultimately is going to lie behind whether or not I believe the truth or I do not believe the truth. That's where faith comes in with the apostles. But what they see as underlying everything is there are two kinds of hearts in the world, those who take pleasure in wickedness and those who take pleasure in goodness and godliness. So that's why I say at heart, what the Christian faith is all about is calling us to be the kind of people who take pleasure in goodness rather than in wickedness, and that at the bottom line of what our faith is all about, it's about the moral condition of my heart. Early in my Christian experience, there was such an emphasis on doctrine in our churches. You know, you have to believe this doctrine and this doctrine and this doctrine and this doctrine and this doctrine, and then you're a good, loyal Christian, and then you can know you're saved. That is so at odds with the spirit of the New Testament. They're not concerned about whether I'm getting all my doctrines right. They're concerned about the moral condition of my heart, the moral commitments of my heart. They see a relationship between what doctrines I might be attracted to and that the moral commitments of my heart. But it's only because the doctrines I'm attracted to reflect the moral commitments of my heart that they see the doctrines as significant, or my belief or rejection or embracing of doctrines as significant. Not because believing them or not believing them is significant in its own, for its own sake.
We've really put an emphasis in the wrong place.
Yeah.
By looking at doctrines, for example. There's a situation that came up with one of my kids. She was at a friend's house, and the friend's parent said, you know, I really believe that God wants all children to be homeschooled, and your parents are wrong for not homeschooling you. That's not a biblical doctrine, but I think she would almost say it is. I think it's in the same spirit that perhaps you learned about things. And so if you're going to be right with God, you've got to be doing particular things, and one of the things that you particularly need to do is be homeschooled or be a parent that does homeschool, or you're really wrong. On the other hand, that same person is very critical of my daughter, openly so, very hurtful, says things that demean her. And my daughter said to me, Mom, if you could go say anything to that person today, what would you say? And I said, well, you know, I really think it's important to, I kind of hedged it, you know, I said, it's really important for me to do the right thing. And so I don't think I would go and talk to that person about this because I'm pretty upset about it right now. And I really value trying to do the right thing. And because I don't think that that person really has ears to hear. I think they really believe in their rule, and anything that I said to them really wouldn't work. And so, of course, my daughter, as always, she's so like me. She just doesn't give up on anything. You know? Okay, Mom, I know you want to be a good person. I know that. I don't need that lecture again. You recognize that? I know that you wouldn't ever go over and yell at her or say mean things, but if I could just really know what you're thinking, what would it be? So this is what it is, and it's really not divorced from, I feel hurt still. I feel definitely some protection for my daughter. And so you're going to hear that coming out in my thinking here. I'm giving a disclaimer to, you're not going to see the most godly part of Christine here, but nonetheless, I think it's in the spirit of what we're trying to talk about. And that's that. I said, now as close as I can come to it, I said, what I'd like to say to her is, I think you're putting the emphasis in the wrong place. You are so quick to decide what's moral for me and my family. You are so quick to condemn and to criticize the way that sometimes the language we use, whether or not the fact that we don't homeschool our children, the fact that our kids sometimes fight among each other. You're very quick to notice that, talk about it, to notice when we go to church and the days that we don't go to church, and to compare yourself and to make it known that you, in your mind, do it better than us. But what I'd like you to do is look at the way you're not loving us and how you're communicating that to us. I think you need to take another look at the way, at what God would want. Does he want you to obey all these rules, or does he want you more to work at being kind and loving people toward us, even though you disagree with us? And of course, my daughter said, yeah, go tell her. But I think that's really the core of the issue. It is okay for them to be, and justified, I think, in their minds, for them to be cruel toward us, really. And yet, really believe in their hearts that they're doing the right thing by obeying these rules better than we do. And I think it's a tragedy when we have put rules above, how do I really love this person? And even if somebody is doing something very wrong, it's still very right for me to be kind to them. The other day I was talking to a friend of mine about someone who was kind of made a decision behind my back. It's quite an old person, and they are used to kind of getting what they want, going their own direction. And I'm going to go visit that person. And my friend said, Christine, that's the way they are. And it's really better that you don't say anything. And I think my friend was right, is that it would be, I could try and change my older friend by telling them how wrong they were and by kind of coming down on them. And I don't think it would be anything but trying to get them to see where they're wrong and where I'm right. It wouldn't accomplish anything. It wouldn't help them. It wouldn't help me. And what I need to do instead is, how do I love them despite the fact that they kind of ran over me? And in this particular situation, it doesn't have to do with confronting them. It has to do with me grieving the fact that they misunderstand me, grieving that I didn't get what I wanted, that I think would be a good thing for me. And I wouldn't have that answer for everybody, but I think it's right in this situation. It is more right for me to love them than to show them what I think the rules are.
I didn't follow what you meant. You wouldn't have that answer for everybody?
People it would be better to confront them.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right.
For some people.
Every situation, you wouldn't, yeah.
Right. And the same with my daughter's friend's parent. I think sometimes it would be great to go and work it out with them and try and help them see. I think they're too steeped in their rules, too steeped in their need to see themselves as a particular kind of ideal person, that my talking to them would only, I think, entrench them in their beliefs that I'm wrong and they're right. I don't think it would soften them. I think it would harden them. And I think it would harden me. I think I would do it just to keep my daughter from hurting and keep me from hurting. And sometimes having to deal with what hurts is far better because it softens me, rather than try to protect myself from what hurts just because I'm right.
And the appropriate thing to do, it seems to me, is the very thing that your friend is not doing. I mean, having spent most of my Christian life thinking the way your friend is thinking, never in a million years would I have thought that I was being unloving when I was, you know, when I was judging people who didn't live the lifestyle that I thought a Christian ought to live, or making the decisions I thought a Christian ought to. I mean, I honestly, in my own conscious thoughts, believed that I was just upholding what was right and good and true, and I was committed to it, and I saw somebody else falling short of being committed to it, and I didn't even think that I was condemning them in the sense that that I was thinking badly of them or being disrespectful of them. I just thought I was telling it like it is. That's how I would have viewed myself. What ultimately lay behind that for me was a lack of self-awareness, a lack of self-knowledge. I just didn't understand that all of what I took to be my commitment to what was right and good and true was really a pretty trivial commitment. And when it came right down to a real commitment to what was right and good and true, life beat me up and showed me that I wasn't such hot stuff morally. I wasn't as good as I thought that I was. But it wasn't until I got beat up and shown how morally inadequate I was that I was then in a position to go back and see life as not quite so easy, as not quite so cut and dried, as not quite so, that I could rethink whether morality was rule-driven or not, and could see the complexity of a relationship with God and realize that different people are going to get there different ways. They don't have to look just like me in order to be a genuinely godly, committed believer. But that takes some real life experience, shepherding you in the right direction for you to even have the eyes to be able to see that. And so one of the things I would do in your shoes is understand that about the other person, that I would be able to be softer toward them because I could understand how I might look to them. Yeah, I see that. I don't think they're right, but I understand that they don't mean this to be taken. They don't mean this as a personal insult against me. It's just the way reality looks to them at this point in their life.
It's really what they believe.
Yeah,
and to try and talk to them about that, especially from a person they don't necessarily respect,
right,
is not going to be helpful.
Yeah,
and I guess where I went with it more than anything is maybe God will teach them that in some way, but I don't think God's going to teach them how to be more loving through my input. I don't think it's going to come from me. And it, quite honestly, for some people, it's easier just to back off. For me, it ain't. It is much more difficult for me to shut up than for me to confront in most situations. I can blast with all guns and come at things pretty irresponsibly. And so it's, maybe that isn't certainly true for everybody. For some people, they're just backing off, not saying something because they're scared of what someone might think. It just doesn't happen to be my personality. It's not where I go. So that's another piece to it. But I think this whole example is just how muddy things can get. It's really not simple. How do I love God and how do I love other people? How do I be a morally right person? It's very complicated. It's very difficult. It's very growth producing, and that's what's good about it. That's what's worth it.
Yeah. It's on the one hand very complicated and on the other hand very simple in that when we come to recognize how complicated it is, we come to recognize how little God is actually requiring of us in the end. Namely, all he wants is for us to love him. Now, how we work out what that looks like in life is the complicated part, but he's not asking us to jump through the right hoops. He's not asking us to do our religion right. He's not asking us to get our doctrine right. All the things that we think he's asking of us and requiring us just really actually are not true. He's not requiring that of us. He just wants our heart to be right toward him. He wants us to love him rather than hate him. He wants us to want to get to know him and appreciate and acknowledge the goodness of who he is, rather than be repelled by him and rebel against him and want to spit in his face and go our own way. And
So I think people are standing up and pulling out their hair about this point, about this time, because we keep on not saying, what in the world is a morally good heart? What's that look like, you guys? Come on, help me out. And I think that that's what you said earlier. It's really hard to describe. And yet, I also know from your sermon that you came up with some really great verses from the Old Testament that are good to ponder, very helpful. Would you like to go into some of those? Or do you think maybe we wait till next program?
Yeah, maybe we need to wait for the next session.
Oh, yeah. Hang on, you guys. What are those programs where they say, wait till the next exciting episode so you can get the answer to this problem, you know, whatever. So is that what we're going to do to people?
I think we better. I don't think we can deal with, well, let's see.
No, I think we definitely should not have people stand by for next week. I definitely think we need to turn to some of those passages and take a look. And one of them is a Psalms passage. Boy, I should know it, but I can't remember which one.
Psalm 51.
Where I love it. Dave, and this is entirely a terrible misquote, but it's something that I come back over and over again. Basically, King David is saying, wow, God, if there is something that I could do, he's kind of scratching his head, is there something I could do that would please you? If I could give you burnt offerings, if I could just kind of come up with some kind of gimmick or thing or doctrine or something that I did that would please you, man, I would be on top of it. I would be doing it right now. But he says, that's not what you're pleased with. What you're pleased with is a broken and contrite heart. Is that a pretty good?
Yeah, that's very good.
Okay.
He did great.
Okay. Kind of use different language. But, Jack, what's he mean by a broken and contrite heart? Or do you want to read the passage so that they get it, apart from my updated paraphrase?
Sure. Let me read at least part of it. This is a psalm that he wrote after his sin of adultery with Bathsheba and after Nathan has come to him and said, you be the man, David, the evil shepherd who stole the other sheep. And David, you know, responds with repentance, and he writes this psalm about that whole situation. And at the end of the psalm, he says, deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God, the God of my salvation. Then my tongue will joyfully sing of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, that my mouth may declare your praise. For you do not delight in sacrifice, otherwise I would give it. You are not pleased with burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. And one of the things that we maybe need to take up in a separate session is does God want us to be religious people? And one of the things that's so significant about this psalm is that David is basically answering that question for us, is no, not really. You're not really interested in my liturgy. You're not really interested in my piety. You're not interested in my religious exercise, my religious practice. What you want is something from inside of me, this broken and contrite heart. And in the context of the story of David, you see exactly what he has in mind, is that's how he responded to Nathan. He was king of Israel. He had the power of life and death over Nathan. He could have had some soldier right there behead Nathan on the spot. He had that kind of authority, that kind of power. But he bowed to the truth. He bowed to the ugly truth about how guilty he was and how blameworthy he was. That's the brokenness. That's the contriteness that I think he's talking about. It's really what I was talking about earlier, that life needed to beat me up so that I came to a point where I realized I wasn't such a righteous hotshot as I thought I was. I was actually pretty morally bankrupt. And it was only when I came to see that I was morally bankrupt that I was beginning to see myself truthfully, objectively, the way I actually was in God's eyes. And then I could really, literally, in a meaningful kind of sense, fall on my face before God and say, God, have mercy upon me, a sinner. That's a brokenness. That's a kind of contrition born out of a knowledge of who I really am before God, where I'm willing to say, God, I have nothing to offer you. I have nothing to commend myself to you. I'm totally at your mercy. Save me. Just the astounding thing that this psalm is saying is, there's all these religious practices that pious people would give you, God. I could give you these things if they were pleasing to you, but actually all you want is for me flat on my face saying, have mercy.
You know, that really reminds me of that series that we did on the Beatitudes, Jack, where over and over again what I heard was, I want to have a broken and contrite heart. I want you to be people who hunger and thirst after righteousness. I want you to be people that mourn. I want you to be people, in other words, that grieve the wrong, that see and grieve the wrong in your heart, willing to face it very openly, very squarely. And the appropriate response is brokenness, nakedness, vulnerability toward God, without defensiveness, without justification. This is just who I am, Nathan. I was wrong. You're right. I would like to make up for it. I'd like to do anything so that I don't have to feel badly about it. But I guess what I'm left with is just feeling bad, recognizing the true guilt that leads me to repentance. Well, you know, Jack, and I'm just sitting here thinking, what a wonderful, wonderful story that is when Nathan came to David and said, you know, you were really wrong. And how easy it would have been for David to get out of it. How easy. Nobody would have challenged him on it. He could have beheaded Nathan and everybody would have shut up. Mm-hmm. And I think in a sense, all of us go around beheading other people so that there aren't any marks left of our guiltiness. And how easy it is, not just for David, but for us in lots of different ways to cover up. And what a huge work it is that God does in our heart to keep us from covering up what could be easy to do and to really say, you know, you the man, for God to say, you the man or you the woman, and for us to accept it is a miracle. And I really covet that in my life more and more. I really want that. And that really requires that I embrace a lot of pain, a lot of recognition of my own sinfulness, a lot of perhaps being misunderstood, a lot of having to eat humble pie. That's my prayer.
Yeah.
That's my wish.
Because a broken and contrite heart does not respond. I mean, if David did not have a broken and contrite heart, apart from beheading him, I mean, in addition to beheading him, would have responded, Nathan, you and God don't understand. That is, no, the truth is not quite what you say it is. You just, you know, you need to look at it from the right angle to recognize the truth of what it is, and then I don't look so bad.
Mm-hmm.
A broken and contrite heart says, you know, I just am as ugly as you say I am. You're seeing it. You're seeing it square. You're seeing it straight. And it doesn't look good. It doesn't flatter me, but it's the truth.
It's when we stop our arguments and just say, you know what? You're right.
Yeah.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, McKenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant, a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The McKenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited. And they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously.
More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at McKenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter News and Views are also available. Information about how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
Christine, for a number of months now, we've been trying to let our listeners know where we stand financially and asking them to contribute as they can. We've got lots of feedback that the program has been helpful to people in a number of different ways. But do you know how we stand financially right now?
The small contributions have kind of trickled in. And in terms of larger contributions, I think we've gotten two. We actually got two $8,000 contributions, and the second $8,000 contribution, the people ask that we match the funds. So they will give up to $8,000 dependent on how much is given up to that amount. So it's a possible $16,000 contribution, which is pretty significant, and it's very encouraging.
So any of the listeners out there who are willing to make a contribution to match the funds, they could support us to the tune of another $8,000 then.
Right.
Great.
Which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So thank you for contributing, and we again encourage you to consider contributing if this program has been beneficial to you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.